Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. He's a social psychologist whose research focuses on the evolutionary basis of compassion, awe, embarrassment, gratitude, and love, the emotional bases of moral intuition, and the abuses of power and the formation of social hierarchies. He's widely known as one of the leading scholars in the study of facial expression. He's a former student of Paul Ekman, the behavioral scientist who landed in New Guinea in 1967 with, as he writes, a packet of photos, film equipment, and a hypothesis in hand, to conduct a cross-cultural study of facial expressions. Keltner is co-editor of Greater Good magazine and director of Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, an interdisciplinary center that is translating the new science of happiness and compassion to thousands of educators, parents, and interested readers. In conversation with Dr. Keltner tonight, and again, after their conversation, they will be opening to you in the audience for questions, so please do wait until the microphone comes to you because we record for podcast. Antoine Bichara is professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Southern California, which is only 10 minutes away, but it did take him an hour to get here this evening, and a professor of neurology at the University of Iowa. His research focuses on understanding the neural processes underlying how we make decisions and choices, and especially how emotions play an important role in influencing decisions. His research also aims at integrating decision neuroscience with research in two key areas. One is mental health, and specifically substance addiction. The other seeks to strengthen and expand interdisciplinary research between the fields of neuroscience, management, marketing, and economics. So, with no further ado, please welcome Dr. Bichara and Dr. Keltner. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the nice introduction.
Thank you, Lisa.
See, I was asked to play the role of a journalist tonight, and I've never done this in my life, so I'm going to try my best. I really enjoyed reading the book. I work in that area, but there's always, all those nice stories you put there. There are a lot of stuff that I didn't know before. I'm going to ask you the very first question because I was intrigued by that concept, the gen ratio. I find that's very intriguing. Can you tell us what it is, how you measure it? I mean, you have ways of measuring it and getting a ratio and all of that.
Right. Well, as I hope we talk about tonight, and for those of you who read the book, I got interested in this Darwinian science of emotions like compassion and reverence and laughter and gratitude and love. And I was looking for a core idea that unites these emotions, that captures their spirit or their intention or their design. And interestingly enough, just as when you go to a museum in a Western culture and it's very hard to find happy faces and pictures of goodness, if you will, it was very hard to find a single word that captured the spirit of these emotions. And I was very lucky to be raised by a dad who grew up in San Fernando and always had me reading Eastern philosophy. And so I turned to Confucius, who's an underappreciated Eastern philosopher. And at the heart of the Analects of Confucius is Zhen, or Ren, or the appropriate pronunciation. And the idea of Ren, or Zhen, is very simple. It's a kindness and respect that brings out the good in others. And I love the quote of Confucius that a person of Zhen brings the goodness in others to completion. Mm-hmm. and does not bring the bad in others to completion. So now, being a scientist, I took that and I said, all right, well, how can I use this idea that's at the heart of these emotions I study as a way to think about a very quick, powerful way to take stock of your happiness? And I came up in my pathological way and my interest in quick measures in this thing called the gen ratio. And my mom just the other day was like, you know, honey, your gen ratio is a little low right now, so it has traction. And the gen ratio is very simple. We, you know, and Antoine and I work in the realm of measurement, which is up top in the top part of the numerator of the gen ratio. You think about all the actions in which you or other people have brought the good in others to completion. Down below, think of the actions in which we bring the bad in others to completion. We were joking backstage about how LA traffic has very low gen ratios, perhaps the lowest ever observed in the human species. And I just found that to be a very compelling and easy way to think about how is my life going right now? How's my marriage? How's my dynamic with my preteen daughter? How's our neighborhood? How's our culture? So that's where it came from.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you next something relates to the title. You do a very nice description about how people, you know, most of the time they focused on negative emotions and the negative side of things. And you made a really nice argument, you know, an evolutionary argument about how the importance of these positive emotions. Right. But the fact remains that there are people, you know, those people who kill in cold blood, you know, psychopath.
Right.
There are people, greedy people on Wall Street these days who ruin other people's life. There are even neurological patients. I mean, I worked with those a lot, and you did some work. Yeah, you mentioned them, where they lose, you know, this capacity, you know, to deal with those emotions. So what do you think happens in those instances, at least the non-neurological people? What happens is that there's some brain systems for positive emotions that shut down. And are you aware that that could be something the opposite, that there's some disease or some pathological condition that wipes out the evil things in our brains and turn us into, you know, positive emotion people?
Yeah. Wow. There are about 5 really important questions in that, and that's terrific observation.
We have 40 minutes. So. So you can do whatever.
So Antoine has worked in a field, really been a pioneer in a field that I've been lucky to be part of, which is studying where emotions reside in our nervous systems, right? And there, I think it's safe to say that we have worked out, thanks to work by people like Antoine, the fight or flight dimensions to the human psyche and to human nature. And most people in this audience know about the amygdala, this little threat detection system in the brain. We know about cortisol and stress-related physiology. You've done work yourself on fear and anger and where it resides in different pieces of the amygdala and different parts of the brain. So that clearly is part of the complexity of human nature. And when I started to do this research on emotions like love and gratitude and compassion, as Antoine is signaling, we just didn't know whether those had neurological underpinnings. And then I would push it even one step further and say, we don't know. We didn't really have a coherent evolutionary account of where these things come from. And so the work that we can start to talk about underway is starting to chart where compassion is in the brain, what neurotransmitters are involved in, or something like oxytocin, in trust. And what that gives us is this, I think, a richer lens on the human condition and the kinds of therapeutic examples you bring up. Suddenly we can start to ask, does the sociopath have deficits in compassion, which we are, I think, some neuroscientists like James Blair are starting to show. They don't. You've done a little bit of this work in this realm of not responding physiologically to suffering or to risk, right? We can start to ask interesting questions about, as Antoine anticipated, are there people Can you have too much of the good stuff, right? Can your compassion and love be on overdrive? And we've actually studied people, manic patients, and I, again, will cite my mom as an inspiration for this, and that's as far as I'll go. I love my mom dearly. But, you know, that amazingly enough, people prone to bipolar disorders and mania have a lot of these physiological systems involved in compassion on overdrive, and they're too connected and giving, right? So by adding this other part, these positive emotions to this, mm-hmm. this complexity of human nature, we start to get a better lens on those types of people. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I know because you worked with Paul Ekman in your earlier days, and he's the one who came up with the idea of there are things like basic emotions.
Yeah.
And people now talk about social emotions. I like to hear the story from you. How did he come up with this? How did he define, you know, what was the basis for saying these are the basic emotions? And do you agree, are they fundamentally different from the so-called social emotions, which include a lot of the emotions that you're talking about, compassion, love, and teasing, and so on.
Right.
Well, get rid of the story from you.
Right. How many of you here have heard of Paul Ekman? That's pretty amazing. And how many of you have watched Lie to Me? Okay, that's based on Paul Ekman's entire research career, and the character is based on Paul Ekman with a few biographical deviations that he was quick to point out to me. You know, I didn't fight with my wife like that. You know, Paul Ekman, every field has its great figures. And as Antoine is saying, Paul Ekman is one of our great figures in the study of emotion and really evolution and facial expression. So the story is really quite remarkable. Paul Ekman was a young guy toiling away in a lab, and he was approached by a funding source who said, gee, we have this money. We need to spend it really fast. Will you go do some cross-cultural work? And Paul's like, no, I'm not really interested. I'll write the grant for you, so please take this money. And he gave him a bunch of money. And Paul tested one of Charles Darwin's ideas. And Charles Darwin, whose 200th birthday is coming up, born the same day as Abraham Lincoln. For those of you who are interested in Darwin and Lincoln, you should read Adam Gopnik's new book, Angels and Ages, who argues that Darwin and Lincoln really give us modern thought in a lot of important ways. Darwin said, we have the same facial musculature as other species, primates, chimps, and bonobos, and that's proving to be the case. And he also said, our loftiest of emotions, reverence, sympathy, gratitude, awe, right, have their mammalian forms in other species. They're part of our evolutionary heritage. Taking on creationists of the day, no one had tested that hypothesis. So first stop in Paul Ekman's biography is he got this money, he went to New Guinea, he lived for six months with these hunter-gatherer individuals who had no contact with Westerners. After getting the blessings from the witch doctor, he showed photos of six different emotions, all negative emotions and one smile, and people in New Guinea judged those faces like Antoine and I would or you would. So very important discovery. The face is a universal instrument of communication. Then what Paul did, which I actually think is more impressive, mm-hmm. came back from that work and he realized the field for the science of emotion, for Antoine and I to sit here tonight, it needed a way to measure emotion around the world, in any lab, with any people. So he spent 7 years of his life, no funding, no publications coming out of this, figuring out how the 30 or so facial muscles, when they move, how it changes their facial appearance. He developed a coding system, takes 100 hours to learn, it drives you crazy. And then once you learn that system and you pass his test, you get to apply it and code emotion in the face. And so it's a remarkable gift, and it really is the foundation for all the work that I did and report on in the book.
Now, I want to ask you something, because I wonder about it as well. Do you think that there is a limited number of emotions, or do you envision a situation like, I'll give you an example, the taste system? For example, in taste, we can appreciate an infinite number of different tastes, but all it boils down to, actually, we only have four different kinds of bud receptors in the tongue, and if you stimulate them in different combinations, you can get, you know, an infinite number of different tastes. So my question applies to emotions. Do we have an infinite number of emotions, or maybe just a certain number, but then all those different, those indefinite shades of different emotions that we experience, they're probably just different combinations of these basic or fundamental ones. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's one of the great questions, and it raises so many interesting issues about emotion. So what we know, and a lot of the work that I undertook in Paul Ekman's lab and in my career, is to map different emotions on facial behavior, vocal behavior, postural behavior. So we know, for example, that... And this is very useful for the parents of teenagers out there, that if a person is interested in sexual desire, they pucker their lips and lick their lips and protrude their tongue, and you will never look at your work colleagues in the same fashion after learning about this. I have one work colleague who pathologically licks her lips when she talks to people. I'm like, back off, right? And when people feel love, they tilt their head and they open their hands, and they get these surges of oxytocin. So we can map... as you'll hopefully read in this book, probably 15 emotions, and a lot of new positive ones that I focused on, in the face and the body, right? Now, Antoine is asking, what happens when you mix all these emotions in interesting ways, right? What happens in consciousness? And my suspicion is we have limited numbers of emotions in our bodies and our faces, and then they mix in fascinating ways up in the mind, wherein you mix, you know, reverence with sexual desire and experience something I've never felt, or whatever it may be. And that's for the neuroscientists, as they develop more precise measures to sort out.
Will you be willing to venture? I mean, just like and the basic emotions, you know, there are six or seven.
No, I think
they're... And the social ones, you want to venture and, you know, identify basic ones?
See, you're hearing some scientists debate something that may seem arcane and weird to you. And there are fights like this, you know, like I've gotten in debates with Paul Ekman. He thinks there are eight emotions, and I'm like, no, there are 14. Okay, I'll give you 12, you know. And I'll take 13, and we bargain for this. So I think there are probably 20 to 25 evolved emotions. And I think when the, just think about it, our physiological assessments of the brain, and then I study the autonomic nervous system, are so primitive. Mm-hmm. But once we're far along, we'll have them mapped in the bodies. Mm-hmm. And I don't distinguish between basic, like fear, and social, because as Charles Darwin said... Mm-hmm. The defining instinct in humans, this may surprise you, what's your guess? Survival? That's Herbert Spencer, who came after Darwin. Sympathy. Darwin in Descent of Man, it's a very underappreciated position, and Adam Gopnik wrote very nicely about this, and I write about this in this book, said that's a core emotion, so that has to be a basic emotion as well.
Mm-hmm. I notice in the book you have, you know, you talk a lot about vagus nerve.
Yeah.
And just for, you know, the audience, just tell you briefly, they're basically, the brain is connected to the body, you know, there are two different channels of nerves. One of them is through the spinal cord, but there is another one through something called the vagus nerve, which is more an internal nerve. And we've done work, basically, we agree a lot with you. I mean, I've done work with patients who had actually stimulator to their vagus nerve. Yes, and so these are patients who have intractable epilepsy, so no drugs, no medicine, nothing works with them. So they implant a stimulator. And you know, it stimulates the vagus nerve, and this would, you know, when the patient feels like a seizure is going to come, you know, they can stimulate it, and then it goes away, and it works very well. But we use it for a different purpose. You know, we use the stimulate and see how it modulates certain functions, like decision-making. So it has a capacity, for example, of improving people. When you're stimulating the vagus, you improve people's capacity to make decisions, so they decide better. And this is true of the vagus nerve, not so much of the spinal cord. So you've done something of that sort. Can you tell us?
Thank you.
Your work with the vagus nerve.
And I, you have to send me those papers. That's very. This area of inquiry astonishes me. The vagus nerve, as Antoine very nicely said, it's almost like an alternative spinal cord coming out of the top of your brain stem. And then what it does is, to the best of our knowledge, and they're still doing basic anatomical studies in mammals, it's a bundle of nerves that winds its way. It influences vocalization and links up with facial muscles. It coordinates your breathing and your heart rate, and that's how we measure it, by looking at that coordination. It goes down to the gut. There are new scientific papers out, you probably know, that the vagus nerve is also controlling your immune system and involved, very importantly, in immune system response. It also stimulates the release of oxytocin, which we can talk about. So here is what is amazing. The vagus nerve calms your heart rate. It is involved in certain kinds of vocalization. It is probably unique to mammals, that's the claim, and I'm not sure how definitive that is. Mm-hmm. And there's a thesis out in the literature, I find this astonishing, that the vagus nerve evolved to coordinate the body to help us connect and take care of others, right? That's pretty striking evidence, if that's true, that we're wired for good. So what we've done, and there's just a explosion of studies on the vagus nerve, right? If you get a nice touch to the back, your vagus nerve fires. If you see a smiling face, your vagus nerve fires. When we, in our experiments, present images of harm, suffering, starving babies, your vagus nerve fires. If kids are seeing images of suffering and they help, it is enabled by increased activation in the vagus nerve. Feelings of compassion are activated by vagus nerve. We've gotten crazy. We're interested in what we call vagal superstars. And for an extra fee, I'll give you the 10 tips on how to be a vagal superstar later. But there are people who have elevated vagus nerve activation when they're just sitting in a lab. And these are people that are generous. They break up fights on the playgrounds. When we sit a vagal superstar around another person, that person trusts them and gives stuff to them. It's amazing. And it introduces a lot of possibilities, and it's great to hear you talk about this, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, about, you know, what are the therapeutic possibilities for stimulating the vagus nerve, for autism, for example, or psychopathy? What would you say?
It could be very, very helpful, absolutely. And it is actually, if you look at it functionally, I mean, people have done these kind of experiments to stimulate the vagus nerve, while doing, a PET study or functional neuroimaging study, just at rest, it increases activity, not, you know, in a very diffuse areas of the brain. It's very specific to areas that have to do with processing emotions and decision making, so they can have very, very helpful therapeutic effects, I would think.
Yeah.
So.
And what excites me, you know, I was part of a field of emotion that focused on fight or flight physiology, right, and trying to figure out how stress harms your body, and we know a lot about that. Mm-hmm. But here's a bundle of nerves, when you think about it, that's linked up to pro-social emotion like compassion and the immune system at the same time. Lots of interesting prospects there.
Now, I want to ask you, this is, again, a question that I struggle with. What do you think the difference is between emotions and feelings? Do you think there is a difference? And then let me build on it, because you talk about William James a lot. Do you agree with his position, or do you agree more with Kennard's position, his student, who went against him?
Right. So I'll start with the second question first. I always had a friend in graduate school, he had the funniest rhetorical approach where he'd say, I have two questions. My second question is, and I said, just call it your first question, you know, and you're okay. And but I will start with your second observation. So, you know, if you want to know the roots of psychology, you have to read William James and his Principles of Psychology. And there's a phenomenal biography of William James out by Richardson, and it's a what a great figure in American history, and what a great thinker. But James had this crazy idea that I actually believe. So, and his idea is that the vagus nerve is one branch of what we call the autonomic nervous system. There are 20 bundles of neurons coming out of your spinal cord that influence your tear glands and your sweat glands and your heart rate and your digestive processes. And James said emotions are differentiated and begin in this embodiment down here in the autonomic nervous system. Each emotion has a distinct part, like the vagus nerve. Think about it. When you go into a church and you or a cathedral and a light is shining down and you go, wow, that's a transcendent moment. James would say the key to that emotion is down here in your a little part of your vagus nerve, near your gut or whatever it was. Weird idea, but I think... and I talk about some of these ideas in the literature. I think he was onto something. There are fear and anger-related parts of the autonomic nervous system. The blush is its own weird response that it's its own autonomic system related to embarrassment, the vagus nerve. So I think that is a plausible thesis and interesting. Second question's harder, and it's the eternal question of feeling and subjective experience as distinct from emotion or expression. I work a lot on, facial expressions. I do a lot of research on touch and tactile behavior, postural movements and embarrassment. And so the question is how do those movements percolate up and become a full-blown experience? And I tend to be in the William James camp, which is kind of moves up through the spinal cord and your vagus nerve to the frontal lobes and the different regions to, what do you think?
Well, for the record,
you are on record.
We are William James, proponents. I mean, I worked, I worked with Antonio Damasio for many years in all our work, on decision making and all the neurological circuitry, is really James' view. And that's the thing. I mean, I went and I asked you the question between emotions and feelings because, again, we sort of support that view and we make a distinction. It's like anything. We have a sensation and we have a motor movement. We view emotion as the output, like the motor aspect of an emotional experience. Right. When you get the facial expressions and so on. Whereas feeling, it's the readout of these body gestures and facial expressions. So it's just signals, when you have your facial expressions and changes in your heart rate and changes in your muscle contraction, the brain reads the signals of all those changes, and it's that reading, that's what gives to what one subjectively perceive as a feeling. And then that's pretty much, what James described. That is, when you get a fear response, you see a snake, your face contract and you run and your heart race, and then you feel scared. It's not the other way.
That's right.
It's not the other way around.
But you see, and Antoine was part of really kind of a revival of this Jamesian view where people who lose track of their emotions, the Stoics, the philosophers would say, what a wonderful thing to not have these disruptions of your mind constantly interrupting your day. But Antoine showed, very importantly, that once you lose those somatic feelings, you lose the wisdom of the body, and you can't make good decisions. Tremendous work. But you see how scientifically it gets hard, because people often will say they feel something and don't show it in the face, and you may be married to somebody like that. People often do the opposite, where they show a lot of an emotion and deny it. I did this study of fraternity guys teasing each other that's in this. They got me in a lot of trouble in the press, but that is in that book. And these guys teased each other in really graphic ways that made me blush as I did the study. But I watched them blush and get embarrassed and like hide like chimpanzees. And when I asked them afterwards, did you feel embarrassed? Like, no way. You know? So it's tricky scientifically to do this work.
Yeah. I'm going to have one more question and then we turn to the audience. And in this one, I'm going to wear the neurologist hat. And it deals with, you know, a couple of chapters that you have there, you know, on smile and laughter.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, phenomena in neurology, like somebody get, let's say, right hemisphere stroke and their face gets paralyzed on the left side. You know, you ask them to smile, they can't. You know, one side of their face is paralyzed. But if you tell them a joke and they laugh, then all of a sudden, you know, the muscles will contract and they would do a nice smile.
Right.
Another one is that there's another condition is called pathologic crying and laughing, where basically there is a disconnection way below in the brainstem, where the patients, just for no reason whatsoever, you know, if somebody walks in, they can throw themselves into hilarious laugh, and then somebody drops something on the floor, and then all of a sudden they turn into crying, and then they can't stop. And both of these things suggest that you do have those mechanisms, you know, to laugh and to do these emotional reactions in areas of the brain that are very primitive, very low. First of all, have you done any work, because you've done the Duchenne smile and so on, have you done any of this in those kind of patients? Number two, from an evolutionary question, do you think that at least laughter, those happy emotions probably are a lot older evolutionarily than what may want to think, because
exactly
given you know how they are represented in the brain.
Yeah. So what a terrific question, and the broad notion that Antoine is talking about is we often have to turn to these really interesting groups that suffer certain kinds of brain trauma or organic diseases to understand where the emotions are located. And then that tells us a bit of the evolutionary history of an emotion and how it got built into the nervous system. So let's take that framework and apply it to laughter. You know, laughter is this mystery in the scientific literature, believe it or not. But there's a very interesting conclusion that this kind of neuroscience brings us to. There's amazing work by Joanne Bakarowski that I talked about in the book at Vanderbilt, showing she's spent thousands of hours tracking the acoustic profiles of laughs, right? And it turns out there's a whole rich vocabulary of laughs, like hisses and snorts and guffaws. And she has this great finding that when you sort of code people's laughs, women emit these beautiful song-like laughs, you know, and men are more likely to grunt, right? And that's a laugh, you know. Friends, when they laugh together, as opposed to strangers, Joanne has found their laughs start to kind of become, they start to mirror each other within a second or so. Remarkable attunement. First clue into the evolutionary history of laughter is... what Joanne found Bakarowski, and I talk about this, it's so important, it's so subtle. We think of humor, most theories of humor, they deconstruct humor as this state of contradiction, and you come up with an insight, and you resolve the tension. It sounds like a really sophisticated, complicated thing. Bakarowski finds laughter, the particular acoustic elements that it's using, predate the elements that we use to speak consonants and vowels, 4 or 5 million years old. Very old vocalization patterns. And in fact, a lot of chimps, if you go to a zoo, do the pant hoot, which is a form of a laugh. To get to Antoine's observation, there are now new studies of these people who suffer from pseudobulbar affect, which, as Antoine richly described, inexplicably, they start breaking out in laughter or crying, right? They'll reach to scratch their face, and they start laughing hysterically, and they can't control it. They start weeping. And new studies at UC San Francisco and some imaging studies are finding that disorder is really located, as Antoine said, down in the brainstem in a really old part of the brain. And a lot of the new rat studies are finding their rats, believe it or not, have these subsonic vocalizations that are laughs. There's researchers who actually have tickled rats. And they, you know. And that, too, is controlled in this old part of the brain. Well, that tells us laughter isn't about complicated understanding, right? What I think laughter is about is shifting your breathing pattern. And have you ever noticed, you never inhale when you laugh. You never go, right? It's more exhale, which calms the body down. And so we use these patients to tell an evolutionary story about where our emotions come from.
And I think we're doing, I want to let you, if you want to say anything that I haven't asked you before we turn to the audience.
Those are great questions. Thank you.
Okay. So maybe then it's time we can take up some questions, right?
Is there someone who has a microphone, or how does this?
You can just point at someone, Antoine, and then... Okay.
I think we
have a... So we go, you're next, and then you're next. And then you're there.
We're looking for... I guess the, you know, are we waiting for a microphone? Please read, all I'll say is, please read Charles Darwin. What really was interesting as I undertook this is I do this connection between Darwin and Eastern thought, and there is so much interesting overlap. And it's interesting, there's new scholarship right now on David Hume, the great philosopher, and it really looks like Hume spent some time down in a French monastery where he had contact with Buddhists. Hume influenced Darwin profoundly. So there's this very interesting emergent scholarship interlocking Darwin and his thinking about human nature and Eastern thought that's best reflected by His Holiness the Dalai Lama through all his contact with the scientists, and I've been part of a few meetings, now calls himself a Darwinian. So please read Charles Darwin.
Thank you. I'm just curious... in the movie The Silence of the Lambs, the Anthony Hopkins character can read people very, very well, it seems.
Yeah.
And you work with Paul Ekman, and I guess your work has something to do with like what he does. But is that possible? I mean, can people get that good? Or like the guy in this Lie to Me series now?
Yeah.
Are there people really that good that they can just watch you and...
There are. Ekman has... So... What we know, first of all, just in thinking about broad distributions of people, is that the better you are at reading the voice and the face and touch, the better adapted you are. And there are a lot of emotional disorders that are going to turn out to, or broad disorders like Asperger's syndrome and autism, certain kinds of anxiety disorders where you're biased not to perceive particular emotions. And so that's a generalization. Ekman's been very interested in finding a set of people who are spectacular at reading emotion. And it's as if they've gone through the facial training that I went through, hundreds of hours. I've coded more facial expressions than any human being alive. I swear to that, and it's ruined my life. And they probably see social interaction in slow motion, where they're picking out little muscle movements and the telltale signs. He's interested in the 1 in 10,000, and they are a very interesting group of people. They're very good in the armed forces, and he's training them for those kinds of purposes.
Okay, now we can have a question here. And then you're next.
Could you mention the evolution in a new baby with the mother?
Yeah.
And what happens positively and negatively?
Are you talking about as the individual develops or in our species evolution?
No, as the individual develops these different emotions. Many babies right away see a face and they identify fear or other.
Right. Emotions. Right. Right. So, you know, the first point, and it's a point that I dwell on in different places in the book. You know, it's interesting how much we neglected one of the most fundamental facts about human evolution, which is that we have these hyper-vulnerable offspring that form attachments. Our offspring have big heads because we have frontal lobes, which Antoine studies, because we like to gossip and talk about each other, so our brains expand. We have very narrow pelvises. Our babies are born very prematurely. Most vulnerable mammals on the face of the earth, taking anywhere from 7 to 40 years to reach the age of independence. And I kid you not, you know, they are... So what that created, and there's a new science of this, but John Bowlby wrote about this. And it really is one of the most obvious but great truths in psychological science, which is the strength of the caretaker to young infant relationship sets that baby's emotional disposition in a particular direction. The warmer, the more secure, the more a lot of the behaviors that I talk about in the book, like touch, tactile contact, the stronger the baby, and the less they'll be fearful. And you can read about it in there. So it can even alter more fearful dispositions, which is what you alluded to.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the Bakarowski theory about laughter, because it was my understanding that it was this irony or this insight that you had that then provoked laughter, and you were saying that because we didn't even have syllables or were able to articulate it through language, but I mean, you don't have to do that with a baby. I mean, baby gets irony, a simple game of like peekaboo, and they'll crack up. And so I don't think you necessarily need words to understand a particular irony or insight. And so I just, maybe if you could elaborate.
Great question. And you know, our science is really only halfway there in understanding what laughter is. But here's a problem for you, which is that there's a fellow named Robert Provine, and I write about this work, and he had a book called Laughter probably 5 years ago. He did what people should have done a long time ago to understand laughter and humor, which is he created these little groups of laugh collectors, and it's kind of a weird term, actually. It'd be a nice career. And he set them loose in malls and dorms and eating houses for college students, and he had them record when people laugh. Well, guess what? About 20% of the time, people are laughing at jokes, right? People try a good joke, like, is that a piece of furniture or a piece of clothing that you're wearing, you know? And they laugh. But most of the time, people laugh when nothing like a joke has happened, when it's not really humorous, when they're just talking, when they're speaking. And that suggests that the kind of the more rudimentary source of laughter isn't humor per se, but it's something else. And what I try to build a case for is what laughter does is it is such a profoundly important development in human evolution, and I think we've lost sight of, is it says, I'm not serious. Whatever I'm doing right now, I'm not fully committed with sincerity to what I'm doing. You know, I had a When I was in graduate school, there was an assistant professor who had this fire drill type laugh. Right? And there was kind of fear, like, wow, I'm not going to get tenure. I'm going to die. But at the same time, he was laughing, and he was sort of saying, but it's not quite as serious as I think. So I think what the laugh does is it doesn't say, hey, something incongruous and funny has happened. Rather, it's a little bit deeper. It's saying, what is happening at this moment is not serious. And that I draw upon a genius of laughter, Milton Berle, who said, laughter is la petite vacation. It's a vacation from reality.
It's over there. So let's, you know, there's a question over here.
I came a little bit late, so forgive me if this was covered, but I have a pretty strong blush, and I'm hoping that there's more than just embarrassment. I'm hoping there's some evolutionary potential benefit from having blush in a signaling kind of way. So,
well, you should feel assured that you will suffer a lot in life, but we'll love you more for it. So, you know, the blush, you know, is there, and this, I hope, you know, Antoine asked such wonderfully framing questions with you know, how do we think about these behaviors and these weird things that emotion people like Antoine and I study. Darwin actually was wrong on the blush. And Darwin, you know, Victorian cult, the English are the great blushers of the world, right? And Darwin, I don't know why, he really missed it. And he said the blush actually may be unique to humans. And he hinted at that. He's wrong. There are certain primates that redden facially in certain situations, and that is a clue to what the blush is. And he thought we blush whenever we turn our attention to the part of our body that we're thinking about, right? So I think of my face and I blush, or I think of my, you know, ring finger and I stimulate blood activity there. And that's wrong. And what a lot of science is showing, and I did, one of my chapters is on embarrassment, and I got interested in embarrassment in Ekman's lab. We were studying the startle response. And it turns out, if you want to know how tense and anxious somebody is, probably your best way to get at it is to startle them, right? If you go, bam, right? That tells you this person is going to be a little agitated if you don't put your socks away. They're very tense. So I was coding people getting startled. And when people get startled, about half of them, in this study, blushed, and they got embarrassed. So I coded the facial display, and you'll see pictures of it, analyzed the blush, and what we came to is an evolutionary story about why you're probably a very good person, which is the blush and embarrassment is an appeasement display. And it looks like many mammalian displays of appeasement that evoke forgiveness. We like people who blush more, who show more embarrassment. And then Antoine and I have worked with people who damage the frontal lobes or parts of the frontal lobes, who have trouble acting in moral fashion, and they don't blush in appropriate fashion. So the blush is a way of saying, I care about what you think and I'm committed to it. So it's a good thing, although you will suffer for the rest of your life. So
okay, there was a question right here. And then I think there was one over there, right? You had a, yeah.
I have to say, when you talked about the laugh, I had a post-traumatic flashback to when I saw George Bush at the podium laughing at all the reporters. But that aside, my question has to do with your understanding of neurological bases for religious experiences and if they've colored your understanding, I guess, of religion and where it fits in our whole capacity as humans.
Do you know that literature, Antoine? Mario Beauregard and
no, not really.
So, so there's a vibrant area of scholarship right now. Ramachandran, who's down at UC San Diego. I think it's the temporal lobe. Yeah. There's a guy, Mario Beauregard, who's a first-rate neuroscientist, who is imaging, doing fMRI pictures, which is what Antoine and I do. Antoine Moore of Catholic nuns as they have a trance-like experience and communion with Jesus. And he's finding that that experience is registered in some part of the brain. We are doing work on my favorite spiritual emotion, which is awe. And I think the best accounts of awe are Emerson, Edmund Burke, and then John Muir, a great Californian, and his experiences in the Sierras. And we find it's part of the left orbital frontal cortex, which is about abstract rewards and pleasures, sort of higher order sources of pleasures. Once you put all of these data together, you then confront a philosophical question, which is, are you a materialist, or are you do you ascribe by some other philosophy? I'm a materialist, and I feel those experiences are built into our neurons, and that's the story. Mario Beauregard feels that he has discovered God in the brain, that there's something supernatural, and that really is a metaphysical commitment about where you stand. But what I do think is very interesting, and there's a lot of evolutionary thought around this right now, you know, why are religions universal? Why do they have similar properties and similar feelings? And there's a great neurological evolutionary story to tell. Where are you?
I'm like you, material. I see. Let's go there.
How do you explain, for example, myself? Like, I sort of naturally smile. Like, I'm always smiling. But that, truthfully, I'm not happy all the time. But people think I'm happy, but, you know, I'm really not. But it's sort of like a, you know, involuntary smiling.
Right.
How...
You should watch the guy who blushes a lot. You'll get happier.
I blush too, but, you know.
Yeah, so, well, you've asked a fundamental question that has occupied crazy people like myself and Paul Ekman for 15 years, and I think the controversy, and we can provide a really good answer to you, which is, you know, here is the complexity of studying emotion. We have a word, smile. Maybe there are a few others, grin and smirk and so forth. But we know it really maps on to dozens, and Antoine even suggests thousands of experiences. How do we make sense of that? So the first, what is the vocabulary of smiles? And the first big distinction, and we could probably, and if you want to come up to my lab, we could do this work, you know, there is a muscle that surrounds the eyes that is called the orbicularis oculi, and it's fair to call it the happiness muscle. And when we smile, the zygomatic major pulls the lip corners up, and that's kind of the service industry smile, right? Then the happiness muscle kicks into action when you're really feeling happy, and that muscle, when it contracts, the cheeks go up, you get these lower eyelid pouches, and the most important part of a good day for me is when people around me have lower eyelid pouches. And then you get those dreaded crow's feet, which the Botox industry is trying to wipe out, which turn out to be the best signs of happiness and love that you can imagine. And when that muscle contracts, we know you're happy. We know the left side of your brain is activated. Little babies, when their moms come toward them, they show that Duchenne smile with that muscle. They only show the zygomatic major smile when a stranger approaches. There are 25 studies that say that's the first step to answer your question. And then what my work did is said, boy, when you add other muscles, you can start to tell interesting stories. Like, if I puff out my chest, that's more like pride around the world. If I add a few lip licks and lip puckers, that becomes lust. And there's a very rich vocabulary of smiles to sort out your states.
We still have time for... Okay, can I see show of... I think, yeah, because I'm sorry, I lost... So let's go here. Yeah, I think I saw your hand first.
Thanks for coming. Wanted to know, are there any studies or any theories on the effect of the new technologies, BlackBerries, chat rooms, the computer, on perhaps de-evolving us and our emotions?
Yeah. Write the book. You should, because it's, you know, I will... man, is that a very important question. You know, when you look at the literature of human adaptation, right, what we know is that we are these amazingly exquisite communication instruments with the face and the voice and touch. I do a lot of research on touch. Big parts of the brain have evolved to pick up information about where your eyes are moving and specific facial muscles. Antoine's been part of that. The voice. That is really a core part of our who we are as humans. And regrettably, the technologies are depriving us of these opportunities to develop that. And I think, one interesting anecdote is as a rhetorical question, I was making the point in my class recently that you have to live in the physical presence of somebody to fall in love with them. It's kind of a truism, isn't it? They have to be around you, right? And I was sort of chuckling and I said, how many of you have ever been in love with someone that you've actually never physically seen? And a third of the class went hands up like that. And I was like, well, good luck reproducing the species. But the point is that, and I think there's going to be, if you did the research right, my hunch is you would track how immersion in these new mediated technologies knocks out those systems. And if you went even one step further, you're Antoine, you could show immersion in text messaging may lead to less interconnection in the face perception parts of the brain. So that I'm sympathetic to your notions. We don't know, though.
We have a question back there. Then you.
Are you the fellow who wrote the article in the New York Times Magazine about teasing?
Uh-oh. Yes, I am.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you what you thought of it. So never mind.
So I have to defend myself, and I am not teasing. It's funny. Boy, did that one stir it up. So one of the points, and there's a chapter on teasing, and it's this weird chapter in the book. I hope, we are born to be good. We're born to do a lot of things. There are a lot of dark dimensions to the human nervous system and human behavior. But evolutionary analysis, let me give you the short story, which is that one of the fundamental axioms of evolutionary analysis is that as a social species, we're in perpetual conflict with others. Siblings, parent to child, mates, hierarchies. As one illustration of that, developmental researchers find on average that siblings get into fights every 6 minutes in American families, and parents are breaking up that fight and getting into a fight every 8 minutes. So, and that's just social life. That is by evolutionary design. We aren't the same genetic organism. So what I argue, across mammals, mammals evolve these ritualized status contests to sort out these conflicts. And I try to make the case, and there are a lot of data that support this, that teasing is a ritualized conflict resolution mechanism. We do it to point out quirky behaviors that could go haywire, and it is much better than the alternative, which is direct person-on-person violence. And there are a lot of data that show, and I'll leave you with this one, romantic couples who have a lot of teasing nicknames for each other are happier, and they use those teasing nicknames, to tease each other about the way they dance or whatever. So I did write that article. It's fascinating. I had a Boston Globe reporter. I got, most people were happy about it. I got emails from all over the world. I'm in an African village. All we do is tease each other. And that's true of a lot of cultures. And this Boston Globe reporter said, something's awry in the West. She had written an article about how kids are using nicknames for parents today. Like my daughter now calls me dude. Hey, dude, right? I'm like, I'm not dude, and she wrote about that as an interesting observation, and she got all this hate mail, like you're ruining this structure of the family, and so it's a very interesting dynamic in our culture. So
let's go here now.
Do you have an overarching theory of the point to emotions?
Yeah. Well, it takes me 30 lectures in my emotion class to fumble at an answer. And I think, thanks to people like Antoine and others, the field thinks, I have two answers for you. The general sense in the field, working at this for 40 years, is that emotions have a really important signaling function that Antoine referred to earlier. I look at a complex stimulus field of all these things happening, and I got to have some kind of prioritization, right? What matters here? And emotions do that work, right? Bam, I get hit with a feeling of compassion that says, whatever you're looking at, there's unjustified harm in front of you, and then the body orients accordingly. And that signaling function applies to, of course, all the communicative behavior. I think, having worked at, you know, on different emotions like embarrassment and awe and compassion and laughter, which we've heard about tonight, I think the more satisfying way to really try to find an answer to that question is to think about emotions, right? That we do better when we think about the functions of vision or audition, right, rather than sensation in general. And I think we do better when we think about, well, what's the function of awe, right? Or certain kinds of fear. So that would be our first answer to that. What would you say?
Well, I mean, it's exactly what you said. I mean, emotions are very important. The positive ones are ones that guide us towards what's good for us, and the bad ones take us away from it. Now, the most dramatic thing is that you would think if you had no emotions, you're better off. And this is exactly what we show in neurological patients, you know, where they damage parts of their brains and they lose their emotions. It's completely the opposite.
And it's so amazing, and I delve into that, how entrenched this notion of, boy, wouldn't we be better off with these disruptive passions? It dates back to Greek philosophers, Immanuel Kant, and the work that Antoine and others have done really calls that into question. So I think signaling is one way to think about it.
So we take one more question? Okay.
So I work with juvenile offenders and foster care kids who've not been able to tap into these positive emotions. And so I wanted to ask you if you feel like there's a way to harness what you're talking about and to help these kids be able to convey what is in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I do a lot of talks to healthcare providers and to people working in settings like you're working. And I think what is emerging out of this literature on emotion that you've just gotten a sample of tonight, and also thanks to people like Danny Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, right, which really revolutionized our thinking about the centrality of emotion, is that, as I hope we've conveyed tonight, that emotions are fundamental to social adjustment, and they are also, they have all these practical tools associated with them that become really important targets of intervention, right? So we know, for example, that with certain kinds of autism and Asperger's, that just training up the ability to track facial muscle movements and eye contact is a major precursor to sort of mainstreaming and really thriving with that condition. We know that, I've talked to people in healthcare facilities or mental healthcare facilities that, you know, redirecting patterns of touch, which is so important to social connection in really violent individuals, is beneficial. And there are a lot of studies on touch therapies. So I think what lies ahead of us is the synthesis of these emotions and these tools that are part of emotion, and bring them to play in your kind of work. And they're really neat examples happening in the field.
Do you have any more time?
I think that will probably be a good place to stop. And
okay.
People could join us in the lobby for the book signing.
Right. Well, thank you very much. That was lovely. Excellent. That was fantastic.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.